My guest at this time is Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse. She is the founder and president of the Ruth Institute and a prominent voice on key cultural issues. And our question for her today is whether Republicans and conservatives are quietly conceding on various fronts of the culture war. For example, when President Trump recently announced a ban on transgenders serving in the military, far more elected Republicans went public with their opposition than went public with their support. Most said nothing. Also, a new poll from Reuters shows that 58% of Americans support transgenders serving in the armed forces. In addition to the expected 83% of Democrats who support such service, 32% of Republicans do so as well. Finally, according to Gallup, a record high 17% of Americans now approve of polygamy, with a significant chunk of those people also rejecting any sort of religious faith. Lots to discuss here, and Dr. Morse, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Glad to do it.
Well, let's start with what I'm guessing you and others who are on the conservative side of the cultural debate might see as good news, and that's what President Trump did with respect to service for transgenders in the military, as well as his decision through the Justice Department a while back regarding the former Obama directive to the public school systems. What's your reaction to those two decisions?
Well, I think those are strong decisions, very good decisions. And in fact, some of the retired generals sent a letter to Trump praising him for the ban on transgender service, in part because of deployability. I mean, even if people could serve who are transgender, are they going to have access to all the continual medical care that they would need under all the different circumstances that the military is called upon to be serving in? And so just from a very practical consideration, even if they can so-called serve, are they deployable? You know, and so the numbers of people are not very significant, and so banning them is not certainly not going to hurt military readiness, and will certainly help it. So I think those were good calls on his part, and you're right. It's surprising that more people aren't supporting him.
Well, let's talk about the reaction now, because as I mentioned in the introduction, as we reported at the time, a lot of Republicans went public with their frustrations with this, essentially giving the LGBT line that this was a clear form of discrimination. We heard it from the likes of John McCain, Orrin Hatch, Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, a lot of folks on the Republican side who, at least in the past, have been on the more conservative side of the debate. While there were some elected Republicans who applauded the move, such as Vicky Hartzler, who tried to lead a legislative effort to ban taxpayer funding for gender reassignment surgery, most of the ones who you would expect to be in favor of the president's decision said virtually nothing in public. So what does that tell you?
Well, what it tells me is two things. Number one, people don't know how to respond to these issues. And number two, they're afraid. There's a lot of fear tactics that have been used by the cultural left, not just transgenders. Transgenders have, you know, sort of perfected the art form, but the art form has been developed and cultivated over the years, starting with feminism, you know, that a man's not allowed to have any opinion on a whole range of topics, or else he'll be called a male chauvinist pig and basically silenced. So that process of silencing people over cultural issues has been going on for a long time. And it's since no one will address it and deal with it forthrightly, it's just getting worse and worse. So it's a combination of those two things, a fear and a lack of real knowledge and understanding about the issues and how to respond to them.
As I mentioned in the Reuters poll, Republican voters seem to be headed in this direction as well. A plurality of them still oppose transgender service in the military, for example, but 32% do support it, which is higher than it has been in the past. So it's not just the politicians, it would seem.
Well, look, here's the thing. If you've got two sides of an issue, and one side you hear every day, steadily, 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 you hear it on the radio, you hear it on TV, you hear it in the news, you hear it on TV, you see it in sitcoms, you see it in movies, you see it in billboards, you see it everywhere, and the other side you hear nothing. Okay, eventually, no matter what the substance of the issue is, eventually the side that's promoting itself constantly is the side that's going to win. And that's why organizations like the Ruth Institute and organizations, all the different pro-family organizations, need to be getting their message out. And people who are concerned about these issues need to be going to places like the Ruth Institute and places like the American College of Pediatricians and other organizations that are providing an alternative to the steady drumbeat of, let's just call it what it is, propaganda coming from the cultural left.
So would you or would you not use the term quiet surrender here?
Surrender suggests that there was ever a fight. To me, it seems like on the political front, at least, there has never been a real sustained effort to push back in a sustained and logical and forthright manner against some of the truly irrational things that have been coming at us from the sexual revolutionaries. And as things get more and more irrational, more and more illogical, it's just looking sillier and sillier to say nothing. But people have practiced that surrender, I guess you could say. Now they've practiced that. I guess it'd be better to call it not surrender so much, because that suggests there was a fight in the first place, but just a refusal to show up to the battle in the first place. You know, the Republicans would much rather talk about taxes and things like that than to go and talk about the cultural issues.
You led perfectly into the next point I wanted to make, because in addition to those like John McCain, Senator Shelby, Senator Hatch, Congresswoman Ross Lehtinen and so forth, who talked about the discrimination side of this, I heard a lot of people respond by saying, well, why is Trump spending time on this when we've got a huge Obamacare fight and we've got Syria and we've got Iraq, we've got North Korea, we've got tax reform? This should definitely not be on the front burner.
Well, the crazy thing about that is that the Obamacare fight is largely a fight about cultural issues. I mean, let's be honest, the abortion issue and the Planned Parenthood defunding issue, those are a huge part of the Obamacare issue. And so to pretend that we can avoid that and just talk about economics or just talk about foreign policy or something like that, I think that's just putting your head in the sand. I think the people here's the basic problem. Decent people don't like to talk about sex in public. And so for a lot of people, even bringing these issues up makes them want to just kind of cringe and go talk about something else, anything else, because they're basically reticent and embarrassed about it. And so that gives the radicals a huge advantage because they're not embarrassed at all. They're not shy at all. You can't shut them up. I mean, they're talking about it all the time. And so what I try to explain to people is that, yes, you know, your mom told you not to talk about sex in public. I get that. But every time you cringe and turn your face away, your opponents are moving forward. You're giving them an opening. We must equip ourselves to deal with these issues in a logical way, in a non-panicked way, and confront the fact that it is irrational to believe that a man can become a woman or that a woman can become a man. It's just not true. Just like it's irrational to believe that children don't need their own parents, which was the premise of the whole divorce revolution, and that it's illogical to believe that men and women are completely interchangeable in every single job in the workplace. That's not true either. And they're certainly not, men and women are not interchangeable where marriage is concerned and where childbearing is concerned. And we're trying to create a whole world where the sex of the body and the gender of the body and our physicality is somehow ruled out and written out of law. And since nobody's ever confronted it, the crazier it gets, the more confused people are. And so that's the kind of catch-up battle that we have to fight as pro-family advocates, is to just return to the basics every chance we get and say, look, men and women are different. You cannot legislate away all the differences, and you cannot magically transform a man into a woman, no matter how much hormones you pump into the body, no matter how many amputations or reconstructions you do, no matter how much the person changes their dress, it's still a man in a dress. It's still a woman who's not really a man, you know. And to try to make everybody go along with the idea that you've just changed a person's sex, you know, this is a huge power grab. And Republicans and conservatives generally, I don't think, have recognized how big of a power grab it is and how much it's really expanding the power of the state.
We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. And Dr. Morse, I want to get to those key points for reengaging in the debate a little bit later, but I still want to dig a little bit deeper into where we are right now, because as I mentioned at the outset, there is also a new survey from Gallup showing that 17% of Americans think that polygamy is morally okay. And obviously that means that more than 8 in 10 do not. However, you know, a generation or so ago, there were some other things that are pretty common now that probably had that same number. So are you surprised at all by that, given that it was in the low single digits about 15 years ago? And what does it suggest about where we're headed?
Well, no, I'm not surprised by it. I'm almost surprised that it isn't higher by this time. And what it suggests is, you know, just sort of rolling capitulation, you know, on these issues. And it also tells me that people have not thought through at all whatsoever what it actually means to have an entire society that's polygamous. And, you know, no one in America really understands that. You have to look across history and across cultures to understand what a polygamous society really means. It does not mean, you know, a cute little sister wives program. It does not mean that women are going to have three men. In practice, what it's going to mean is that wealthy men have a lot of wives. That's what it means. That's historically what it's always meant, and that's what it will devolve into. And you know, people are just not thinking that through. But that's not surprising because they're not thinking through what it means to put a child onto a lifetime of hormones because you think the child was born the wrong sex somehow. We're just not thinking things through. We're being maneuvered and manipulated by the soundbite culture that is very, very noisy. And if unless you give yourself some silence, unless you give yourself some time to think, you're going to be pushed and pulled by the latest noise-making machine that comes near you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this issue in one more question, and that's from the right. This is more of a libertarian argument than a conservative argument, I would certainly suggest. But there are folks out there saying, well, the Constitution never talks about marriage, so who are we to say that it should be illegal? Why don't we just leave this up to the states or even just leave it up to consenting adults to do this? So what do you make about that argument coming from the libertarian right, at least?
Well, you know, that's an argument that I engaged with on quite a few occasions when the subject was gay marriage in the first place. You know, that's where this topic first kind of came up, is let's get the government out of the business altogether and not worry about it. And the thing that people overlook, particularly libertarians, but not exclusively libertarians, the things people overlook is that the reason you need some kind of institution like marriage is to protect the interests of children to have their own parents. And if you start from the premise that children are entitled to a relationship with both of their parents, the two people who brought them into being, if you start from that position and you reason your way outward, you will end up with traditional Christian sexual morality. That's where you'll end up. That whole system of sexual morality was meant to protect the rights of children to be in relationship and to know who their own parents even are, you know. And so we've lost that on multiple fronts. And the fact is, libertarianism cannot survive a direct confrontation with children and the problems that children present, because children impose obligations on their parents. You know, you have a child, you got an obligation there, and it doesn't matter what the law says. The law of nature says you have an obligation, you know, and to try to legislate against the law of nature on the scale that we're trying to do in our culture is one more example of the irrationality of the sexual revolution as we've seen it unfold here in the last 50 years.
Dr. Morse, how steep of a learning curve do those who believe in the traditional view towards sex and marriage have when it particularly comes to the millennial generation? When this story of Trump and the transgender ban came out, I have a number of interns here, and they helped me select stories for another podcast that I do that involve good, bad, and crazy news. And every intern thought that was the crazy story of the day. So, and these are conservative to libertarian-leaning college students. So how much work needs to be done when it comes to the younger adults in particular?
Well, here's what's happened with the younger generation. The younger generation has witnessed the divorce and remarriage of their parents. And they have witnessed, if not their own parents, they've seen it amongst their friends' parents. You know, so an awful lot of college students have already experienced divorce maybe two or three times by the time they get to college. Okay, that's not unusual. And what that means is that the idea that marriage has something to do with the stability of a child's relationship with their parents, that idea is completely foreign to them. And when I stand in front of a college audience and I say kids have a right to their parents, you know, it's not, they burst into tears sometimes. They've never heard anybody say that. So when that's the case, when that's where they're starting from, the idea that you can reconstruct the body, that doesn't seem too weird to them. You see the problem? So it is a steep learning curve in one sense. But again, I would really suggest to adults that you start with the most basic point, that we conceded a long time ago. I mean, you want to talk about silent surrender. We surrendered on the divorce issue a long time ago. We've got to go back and fight that battle. We've got to go back and stick up for the rights of children to know their own parents. And that's what lifelong married love preserves. And that's what the cultural support for behaving yourself inside your marriage, you know, that you don't go bossing people around, you don't go smacking people around, you know, that you're supposed to love each other inside the marriage. And if you don't feel particularly loving, well, you know, by golly, you act the part anyway, you know, and you do that for the sake of the greater good of the whole family, including your kids. You know, you don't just get to do any old thing you want. And so if we start from that perspective, we will at least have some credibility with the millennials. If you just drive right in and say gay people shouldn't have kids or transgender shouldn't serve in the military, if you dive in there and never acknowledge the 40 or 50 years worth of suffering that divorce has caused, you know, you have no credibility at all. And so that's why we at the Ruth Institute have put so much energy into talking about children of divorce, creating the Healing Family Breakdown Spiritual Workshop, you know, all these kinds of things to deal with the harm that family breakdown has really caused, because nobody's doing it. And it's absolutely got to be done. You can say all day long that now that's too hard, but I'm telling you, there's no shortcut. We've tried the shortcuts. They don't work. Let's get back on the narrow path here.
Dr. Morris, I was going to ask you how to re-engage in the debate, but I think you just explained it perfectly. So thanks very much for your time today. We really appreciate you taking the time to dig through these issues that are clearly impacting our culture in a major way.
Well, you're very welcome. Glad to do it.
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morris is the founder and president of the Ruth Institute. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.